to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Politics Ohio with Emily McCord, and we'll hear from Juliet Fromholt and her special guests on Kaleidoscope this week, the Stillwater River Band. And in our second segment, we speak with writer Molly Campbell about her new book, Characters in Search of a Novel. Up first.
Jacob Marley was dead. Let's be clear on this one fact before we begin our tale. He was as dead as a coffin nail. Well, as dead as a coffin nail can be, dead and buried in the ground these 7 long years. Jacob Marley was dead.
That's just a taste of what you'll get if you go see one of the upcoming performances of A Christmas Carol, A Dinner with Dickens. It takes place at the Hamel House in Waynesville each weekend through December. Performer and storyteller Eric Wolf joins me in studio this morning. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So let's talk about Dinner with Dickens. This is the 5th year for this event.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. The Hamel House has been a great exploration of what it means to explore storytelling and comedy.
I want to talk about the Hamel House, but first, this performance is noted as being 1/3 Masterpiece Theater and 2/3 Saturday Night Live. Explain.
Well, it's a ghost story. So you have to begin with the ghost, and you have to do the ghost in the full as a ghost is meant to be done, the reality of what it means to be confronted by a ghost. And it's a wonderful piece, and it's very serious. It's kind of a little scary. I don't do it too scary because the kids come, make it family friendly. But in the end, the first piece is a very serious cold night of the soul. And the second two acts are about reformation. They're about Scrooge's journey back from the darkness. And that's joyous and wonderful. And the audience, having experienced this sort of dark night of the soul, the second act begins with a fairy spirit who appears, and just we're off rolling and laughing for the rest of the show.
And so this is a one-man show, and you do each of the characters?
I do all the parts in succession as quickly as possible, switching back and forth. I take down the fourth wall, so I have certain lines that I'll say, and the audience will go. So if I say, for example, "Bah, humbug," and then the audience is trained to say, "Merry Christmas." And so it's written into the various dialogues. And so the audience becomes the people in the tavern. The audience becomes the people at the party or the street urchins that Scrooge shakes his stick at. The audience is part of the production.
So this is the 5th year for the event, and that tells me that it's quite successful and the audience response is a good one.
Yeah, we sold out 7 of 9 shows last year. And we only have 12 shows this year, so I'm expecting we'll sell out a bunch of them too.
Let's talk about the Hamel House. You also mentioned that Waynesville is of English descent, so it's an appropriate setting for your event. And I don't think many people know that. Can you explain?
Well, first of all, the building itself was built in the 19th century, so it sort of has a rustic, old-fashioned air to it. And second of all, it is haunted. It's actually a registered haunted location, and during October, it's almost impossible to get seats for dinner there.
Oh, really?
But, you know, people are just constantly coming there. Ghost hunters come from around the world to explore the Hamel House. I haven't seen the cat. I heard there's a haunted cat. but it's a great place to tell a ghost story, and that's what A Christmas Carol is. I mean, we forget that part, that it is, in fact, a ghost story.
What drew you to this particular event, A Christmas Carol, loved by many, but for the same reasons?
I was dragged kicking and screaming into this piece.
Oh, yeah?
I totally had no interest, and they invited me one year, and I needed the money, and I went, and I did it with someone else. I'm not doing it alone, and my friend Dave Epley did it with me, and he taught me the comedic elements of it, and the next year I did it half-heartedly, and then the third year I fell in love. And I've been in love with Dickens ever since. And I just feel like the piece has everything to do with what's happening right now. You know, the struggle between those who have and those who have not, the compassion between those who care for others and those who wish to just care for themselves. And also the role, like, you know, what role does government play? What role do individuals play? And it's all there, and it's all done in a wonderful light spirit because it's Dickens, but it's there in the text.
You mentioned having to learn the comedic element of this particular presentation, but that's not something you're unfamiliar with, certainly comedy in storytelling.
Well, yeah, stories have sort of a comedic narrative within them, but to be a comedian, to be able to respond instantaneously to what has happened with the audience is a skill that has to be learned, and this show has taught me that skill, and it's a great gift.
Well, you're in costume today and feeling the character, so I'd like to ask if you would present us with a little bit more from A Christmas Carol, A Dinner with Dickens.
Scrooge's eyes were drawn up onto the mantelpiece. There he beheld a bell whose string had long since rotted off, the bell whose hand no man or woman had touched in many years. He saw the bell begin to turn, and it began to ring. And Scrooge felt as if the ringing was inside his soul. And then when the ringing stopped, he felt a moaning. And a groaning and a pounding, and the pulling and the sounds of many chains. And through the door walked Jacob Marley, dead these 7 long years. "Chains," said Scrooge, "you only have 1 chain." "Oh, Scrooge, do you not know the pain of state budget cuts?"
Storyteller Eric Wolfe in studio with us, acting out a scene from A Christmas Carol, Dinner with Dickens.
And I apologize to those real Dickens who understand that I just cut 3 or 4 important parts to make that work. So I try to stay as true as I can to the story, but I'm not acting. I'm not reading the text. I'm not memorizing lines. I'm telling the narrative as I know it, and each show is slightly different because of that. And because of the responses the audience has. And that's the best part about it, is that when you go, what you experience that night is entirely different than what the audience experienced the night before or the audience will experience the next night. And to me, that is the magic of the storytelling art form, is when it's really in its freshness and its most exciting element, it is in its moment complete and holds you alive and well. And then it's over.
Well, you have a podcast called The Art of Storytelling. And remind our listeners, we've talked about it before, but how long have you been doing that?
Well, I'm on break right now. So I haven't really produced a show since last December, to be honest.
Okay.
But I have about 500,000 downloads at this point from all around the world. And I've interviewed 123 different storytellers from different traditions, master storytellers from around the world. And if you want to learn the art of storytelling, all you have to do is go to www.artofstorytellingshow.com. But since we're on the importance of websites, I would just say, hey, if you want to learn about the Scrooge Show, go to www.ericwolf.org/Scrooge.
A Christmas Carol, Dinner with Dickens. It's taking place at the Hamel House in Waynesville each weekend through December. And Eric, one more time for our listeners, the website where they can get more information and showtimes.
Well, if you go to my personal site at ericwolf.org and then put a slash after it and write the word Scrooge, and you'll go to the subpage all about the show, when the dates are, and a little video sort of taste of what the show's like.
Great. Storyteller Eric Wolfe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks so much for joining us. Molly Campbell writes a blog called Life with the Campbells, View from the Empty Nest. She writes monthly for the website Moms Who Need Wine, and she's won honorable mention twice at the Irma Bombeck Writing Contest. Her new book is called Characters in Search of a Novel. And Molly, you've told me a little bit about the backstory, but I think our listeners are going to be particularly interested in this. Tell me where the idea came from.
Well, first of all, I've always been fascinated with funny names, and I like to make them up. My husband and I used to look in the phone book and pick out funny names and wonder about, you know, what would, if you had a funny name like Florence Tittlebaum, what would you be like? So about 2 years ago on Twitter, just for the heck of it, I started a Twitter stream called Characters in Search of a Novel, in which every day I would post, and you know, on Twitter you only get 140 characters, so it has to be small. I would post a name and then a quick description. And I did this for a whole year, one a day, 365, never even wrote them down. I just would post one and then forget it. And then at one point, a pretty famous author by the name of Robin Black, and I'll plug her. Her book is called If I Loved You, I Would Tell You This. She writes short stories, and she's got a novel coming out. She tweeted me and said, Molly, you got to quit throwing these away. You need to hire an illustrator, illustrate each of the character names, and write a story about them and put them in a book, and it'll sell. So not one to ignore advice from somebody famous. I started a website posting two characters a month and a story with a picture, got enough going to have about 20 of them. Then I took the website down. That was just as a way of kind of getting some, you know, advance following for it. And then I wrote another 20 or so stories and published the book myself on Amazon.
And so for our listeners, give an example of the things you would tweet. Or the characters.
I would tweet. Well, the most famous one is Loretta Squirrels. And that tweet went every day. I started out with today's character in search of a novel. And Loretta Squirrels, colon, she beats her husband and makes moonshine. And I'm trying to think if there are any. Minerva Pickles was a dog's body extraordinaire. Danny Violets is a hood. And just on and on and on. And as I said, there's so many that I did and forgot. But so they're all unusual in one way or in another, and some of them are just regular everyday people. And I'm a humor writer mostly, but not every story in the book is funny. Some of them have a little pathos.
And did you find it difficult to turn these tweets into slightly longer character essays?
No, because I am a writer. I absolutely loved it, and I fell in love with the characters as I was writing them. They really wrote themselves. Once I got a one-sentence definition in my mind of who this person was, the story just wrote itself. And I just absolutely love doing it. And now for my next attempt at writing, I'm going to write some longer stories. Each one of these is probably under 1,000 words.
You've got a blog dedicated to or about life with the Campbells?
Yeah. My blog is just an Irma Bombeckian kind of a blog. I write about everything from my husband to cleaning the house to comments on the world at large. So that is totally different. That's a nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. But you dedicate the book to your family members, all of whom are characters. Tell me about how much inspiration they are to you and your writing.
Well, I couldn't have written my blog without my husband as inspiration. Charlie Campbell, who also has a radio show here on WISO, is an accordion player and the most enthusiastic person in the world, but he's also kind of a pain in the neck a lot of the times. But he is fodder for a lot of my blogs. And my kids, of course, roll their eyes at me, and I'm just the woman who makes their sandwiches. So in part, I write to prove to my daughters that I'm more than just their mom.
Since you write about your family and most of the characters in the book are individuals, but you also, it looks like, feature a family, the Tarnations.
The Tarnations.
Any relation to your family?
No.
Any inspiration there?
No. However, the Tarnations are totally fictional. But the very last story in the book called Persis and Rex is really based on me and my husband as I projected ourselves into when we're both in our 80s. So that one is the only one that has – well, there. I beg your pardon. There's one more. The Maestro is a story in the book that I wrote about my father, and that was one of my Irma Bombeck winning stories. It's actually true, but it could be a fictional character as well. So my father, the Maestro, is in the book.
Let's play a little character roulette, and I'm going to call some names, perhaps, hopefully, that you haven't mentioned so far. And if you could just tell us a little bit about them. Patsy Purvis. What's her story?
She makes cakes, and she makes the best buttercream frosting in the world.
Okay. And Mimsy Carruthers?
Mimsy Carruthers she's a little girl. I can't remember how old I said she was, but she's writing her will because she feels that she needs to dispose of her earthly goods.
And the Cat Lady?
The Cat Lady is an Appalachian similar to Loretta. She might live in Loretta's town, but she lives in the holler and cares for literally probably hundreds of cats.
Now, putting your relationships with friends and family at risk here, were there any, and you don't have to name them, but any inspirations from real-life characters in your own life?
Well, other than my dad, yes. There's another one in the book named Mrs. Mason, and she that actually is, a true story about my very best friend when I was a little girl when I was 7, and she was an older lady. But there's a little bit, of course, of me or people I know in every single story. And I tried to work the names, the actual names of my family into the book one way or another, but just their first names. But no, I think a lot of it is just straight out of my crazy imagination.
Now, for your writing, you've won the Irma Bombeck Award. Can you tell us about that?
Every 2 years, the University of Dayton, the Irma Bombeck Writers Workshop, they sponsor a wonderful conference and also a contest through the Centerville Public Library where people can send in their writing and they pick winners in two categories, human interest and humor. And I won in humor 2 years ago and in human interest this past year. And it's a wonderful way to gain exposure and validity, I guess, as a writer.
And you've received accolades from Matthew Bombeck, Irma's son, who invites people to sit down and learn these characters and says that folks won't regret it.
Well, one of Matthew Bombeck's childhood friends was his dad is a friend of my husband's, and his dad sent my blog link to Matthew, and Matthew read my blog, and we started a kind of a little friendship. And so when I – and this was before I even this is once I started blogging and once I'd won the Bombeck Award once. So anyway, I emailed Matthew and asked him if he would read my book and write a blurb for the cover, and he was happy to do that, and he liked it, and I'm thrilled that he wrote a blurb for the back of the book.
I want to read from the back cover. It says, Molly D. Campbell is a 2-time Irma Bombeck Award-winning writer. She is married and the proud mother of 2 grown daughters who pay their own bills. In parentheses, this is wonderful. Molly's husband plays the accordion. This is tragic. Tell me how that landed on the back cover.
Well, you know, you have to write so many things about yourself, but really it is tragic because I have to listen to that accordion music wafting up from the basement hours and hours and hours and hours a week. And I started out thinking it was a great thing that my husband took up the accordion, and now I'm not so sure. He has no talent but an awful lot of enthusiasm.
And your daughter's paying their bills?
That's wonderful. I mean, but my one daughter is a talent agent in Hollywood, and she, you know, has been very successful. My other daughter is a Spanish teacher in the Dayton Public Schools. So they're both married and self-sufficient, and that's a great thing in this day and age with the fiscal cliff.
So you've got an event coming up December 6th at the Dayton Art Institute in which people will be able to spend an evening with you and the characters from this book. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Dayton Art Institute is sponsoring my book launch event, and I'm thrilled about that because my illustrator, and I should mention his name, Randy Palmer, who's a local artist, and he also has had works at the Dayton Art Institute, at 6 o'clock in the General Motors Rotunda, the main entrance of the Dayton Art Institute. We're having my book launch party, and there will be a raffle, and there will be prizes. And then at 8 o'clock that evening, Charles Phoenix, who is apparently a very hilarious stand-up comedian, he also is a character and does his act based on Kodachrome vintage slides of unusual people that he has bought at garage sales. And he does a show about those characters. So between the two of us, I think it'll be a fun evening.
Molly Campbell is the author of Characters in Search of a Novel. The book features illustrations by Randy Palmer. There's also an event coming up at the Dayton Art Institute. You'll be able to spend an evening with Molly and some real characters from this book. Molly, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
Coming up next on Why So Weekend, Dayton's Stillwater River Band is preparing to release its debut album in January. Earlier this week, the band visited the WISO studios for a live set on Kaleidoscope. WISO's Juliet Fromhold began by asking singer and mandolin player Chris McFadden how the band got together.
Josh, Dylan and I, the guitar player, we've been friends for a long time, skated, grew up together, and we kind of got tired of playing metal and punk and figured we'd try something different. We both kind of were into the music a little bit, just from family and stuff, but had no clue what we were doing and just started getting together on cold nights with toasty beverages and acoustic instruments, and it just kind of developed from there. The rest of it was a Craigslist ad.
So tell me about your writing process, especially starting out, since, you know, by and large, you guys weren't, you know, growing up listening to necessarily the exact style that you're playing, you know, some influences here and there. How did you begin to tackle forming songs and forming your sound as a band?
I think a lot of it, you know, if you listen to it a lot, I think a lot of our stuff is still pretty aggressive. And if you listen to the lyrics even a little deeper, it's pretty political and uprooted in our youth and, you know, kind of just more flourished in our later years through acoustic music instead of amplifiers blowing your eardrums out and such. But as far as writing songs, I mean, it's really just kind of a process of looking at what's around you and being able to interpret it yourself and spit it back out. And so I guess that's where a lot of my songs come from, is just aggression towards what's around you on a daily basis. And some are happy, but by and large, they're somber, I'd say.
You guys are going to have the new album, January of 2013. What does the rest of the year look like? Are you going to try to get out on the road, play a bunch of live gigs in the spring, do festivals in the summer?
Yeah, I'd say about all of that. We're about a 3 to 4 hour radius right now is the goal from Dayton, so we're not getting out there too far. We don't have a van, and I don't want to get out too far and get stuck out at sea. So we're looking for surrounding, you know, states and stuff, and we've got a couple connections outside of the area. So we're definitely looking to do some traveling.
When the album comes out, are you doing just a traditional CD release or digital or all of the above?
All of the above. Yeah, it'll be available off of our website for order or download. As well as you can come see our wonderful smiling faces and purchase it live anywhere we are.
I think we're just about ready for one more live one, guys.
Yeah,
sounds good to me.
These hills call me back to the place where I belong. Mountaintops and starlit nights, no worries or no wrong. The only ash, the sycamore, has stood the test of time. Been here quite a long while, piercing upwards towards the sky. And down in the valley, the sweet whispered breeze of those who come and those who pass and those that still believe. The tender warmth of fire, my elders blanket me. They cast their light onto the night and stars so I can see. It's in the Appalachian, my footsteps carry me through hills and hollows of happiness to the simpleness of being. Well, in the Appalachian, the memories never fade. Them seeds won't sow into kindred heart, the past's already laid.
Stillwater River Band performing live in the WISO studios. To hear more of their interview on Kaleidoscope and additional live songs, visit our website, wyso.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. A decision this week by the Ohio Supreme Court validated the maps for state House and Senate districts. To talk to me about what this means is Ellis Jacobs. He's a voter advocate and an attorney with Advocates for Basic Legal Equality, or ABLE. Welcome.
Thanks, Emily, for having me.
It can be really confusing when we're talking about this process because in redistricting, there's really two different things going on. When it comes to this Ohio Supreme Court decision, though, we're talking about the state House and Senate districts.
That's right. The Supreme Court decision is limited to how the state map is drawn, the map that determines state Senate districts and determines Ohio state House districts, state representative districts. It's limited to that. I like to say that redistricting, whether it's state redistricting or federal redistricting, is the most boring but most important thing in politics. People have a very hard time understanding just how important it is and how it works.
The whole crux of it is the idea that, a lot of these counties, these local government entities are actually being split up in advantageous ways to a certain political party.
That's right. And the folks that challenged the state house maps in this Ohio Supreme Court decision pointed out that I think they said 49 counties are divided in 75 different ways. And the Ohio Constitution says you're not supposed to do that. The Supreme Court majority, however, says, you know what? It's not against the Ohio Constitution to draw the maps in a way that gives partisan advantage to one party or another. The Ohio Constitution doesn't have an opinion on that.
Was this strictly on partisan lines here that they did it, or was this a contested decision?
No, the decision is 4-3. There was a strongly worded dissent. There's only one Democrat on the Supreme Court. She was in dissent. She was joined by two Republicans. And they said that, number one, this idea that you would have to prove the maps unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't make any sense. The beyond a reasonable doubt standard is a standard you only use in the criminal law. And secondly, they said that if you're going to say that we're going to have great deference to the previous maps, basically what you're saying is that we're never going to overrule any maps that are drawn for any purpose in Ohio. And I think that's really where the law stands right now in Ohio. The Ohio Supreme Court has essentially, with this decision, said we're taking ourselves out of this. We're not going to intervene to change any maps that are drawn for redistricting for the state house. And so that's, I think, what people can expect going forward.
Well, now that the election is over, we can sort of look at this through sort of hindsight. What can we draw as far as the results are concerned about what impact these state redistricting maps have had on the election?
Well, every 10 years, the maps are redrawn, both the state maps that we've been talking about and also the federal map that guides the districts for our congressional representatives that go to Washington. So every 10 years, they're redrawn, and we just did it in 2011. And based upon those new maps, we had the elections that we just had in 2012. And when the maps were redrawn in 2011, people looked at them and said, well, you can see which districts are drawn to benefit which party. And in fact, Ohio elects 133 people from state congressional districts, state Senate districts, and federal races. And of those 133 districts, 131 of them went exactly the way the maps were designed. They yielded the result that was intended. And that's kind of unfortunate. Basically, what it says is that the map drawing process matters a heck of a lot more to the outcome than people's opinions and how they choose to vote. As you know, this year, the Democrats did much better than they had 2 years earlier. You might have thought that they would have gained some seats in the Ohio State House. They didn't. The maps were freshly drawn. They yielded the result that that was intended.
The Ohio Supreme Court, okay, so they're not going to touch it. Issue 2 just failed. What's going to happen next to address this?
Good question. There are a number of things that are in play right now. There's a Ohio State House Commission that's looking at it, a redistricting commission. Nobody really expects them to do a whole lot. And then there's this Constitutional Modernization Commission that was working in the state of Ohio right now that will go on for the next 10 years, and they'll probably look at it as well. So there'll be some things in these formal processes, but probably what's going to happen is that some of the players at the State House and some of the people that have been pushing for change, the folks that were behind Issue 2, will probably be talking, and maybe, because everybody says they want to change it, because everybody says the system's broken, maybe they'll come to some resolution. I think either way, you're going to see the folks that push for Issue 2. And that's the League of Women Voters and Common Cause. I should say that I was a part of that process as well. You're going to see those folks continue to push for it, whether it's in the formal legislative arena or whether they again go to the ballot with some sort of constitutional amendment.
I've been speaking with Ellis Jacobs. He's an attorney with Advocates for Basic Legal Equality. Thanks for being here today.
Sure, Emily. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of OISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, the Book Nook.